Hi, I'm Elena Harkness, Executive Director of Current and CEO and Principal Investigator for Great Lakes Renew, and you're listening to the Water Values Podcast.
The Water Values Podcast is sponsored by the following market-leading companies and organizations. By 120 Water, new rules need new tools. By Advanced Drainage Systems, our reason is water. By 1898 & Co., possibilities powered by experience. By Woodard & Curran, high-quality consulting engineering, science, and operations services. By Intera, innovation and stewardship for a sustainable tomorrow. By Xylem, let's solve water. By the American Water Works Association, dedicated to the world's most important resource. And by Black & Veatch, building a world of difference. This is Session 261.
Welcome to the Water Values Podcast. This is the podcast dedicated to water utilities, resources, treatment, reuse, and all things water. Now here's your host, Dave McGibson.
Hello and welcome to another session of the Water Values Podcast. As my daughter Sarah said, my name is Dave McGibson, and thank you so much for joining me. And thank you for your support over the past 10 plus years. Really appreciate it. We have a great show for you today. Doug Hattler returns for an interview, an impassioned interview, I might add, on the topic of PFAS eradication. Doug does, as he always does, a great job framing the issues and explaining where we are within that greater context. You're really going to enjoy this episode and interview from Doug. For our Bluefield on Tap segment, Reese Tisdale discusses the California water conservation mandates. But as you well know, before we get to the main event and the Bluefield on Tap segment, we always take time out to say thank you to our awesome sponsors at the top of every show, and we have some fantastic sponsors for you, including a new Fortune 500 company that has sponsored for the last half of 2024. So that our sponsorship lineup now includes 120 Water, Advanced Drainage Systems, 1898 & Co., Woodard & Curran, Intera, Xylem, the American Water Works Association, and Black & Veatch. And that, my friends, is a terrific collection of impactful companies that have affirmatively decided to support water industry thought leadership and education. And I thank you all. And I'd like for you to do me a favor. If you work for or with any of those sponsors, please thank your boss or thank your contact at the sponsor firm and tell them that you appreciate their leadership in the industry through the sponsorship. You'd be surprised how far that simple little note of thanks will go. And as long as you're letting the sponsors know how much you appreciate their support of water industry education thought leadership, hey, why not leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or whatever other podcast directory you're accessing the podcast on? It'd be greatly appreciated. Helps others find out about the podcast. And also, please don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Yes, I understand that might have some importance. Before we head on to the interview with Doug Hattler, however, we've got a Bluefield on Tap segment with Bluefield Research's Reese Tisdale addressing the California water conservation mandates. So take it away, guys. Reese, welcome to another Bluefield on Tap. Great to have you on board. What's going on?
Man, it's summertime, Dave. It's been, we take July off, so it's been a while since we caught up. And as we always do, when we were talking about scheduling this, Seattle Mariners, how about that?
Well, they were pretty active. They were pretty active at the deadline, but they still dropped 2-3 to the Red Sox at Fenway. So a lot of baseball left to be played. But at least we didn't stand pat at the trade deadline.
As you would expect. Consider it a victory.
All right. So a lot going on. As you said, we took July off. You had 2 months to conjure up something to talk about for this Bluefield on Tap. What has risen to the top of the heap this go round?
Oh, that's 2 months. That's a lot of pressure. So I think one thing that people, I don't know if people are talking enough about, and it's been sort of a bit of a slow moving decision over the past year or so. But really, I'm interested, and our team is interested in what's happening with the California water conservation mandate. So they've basically set a conservation target for 405 cities or urban suppliers that's going to impact 95% of Californians over through 2040, 2050, really.
Yeah. So can you give us a thumbnail on what the impact is or what the regulations require?
Yeah. I mean, so basically what they've said is, you know, one thing is it's not a wide sweeping like they did in the past. It was Jerry Brown was a governor when they implemented conservation mandates as part of the, you know, drought measures. This is basically what they're saying is we're going to try to save, you know, almost 4 million acre feet through 2050. It's going to play out over time, but also it's more flexible in the sense that it impacts different communities or different suppliers differently. So based on sort of an algorithm, if you will, water service providers or water urban water providers, you know, if you are in the Central Valley or Southern California, you're going to have to save a lot more than, let's say, Northern California. So Northern California, one, there's more access to water. They also just use a lot less water. So they're likely going to be less impacted, if at all, based on where they currently are. So the impact financially will be approximately $4.5 billion over the time period, so 2040. But the expectation is over $6 billion will be saved in water procurement, water spending.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. You know, so often you hear what the cost is without kind of netting it against what the avoided costs are, and so interesting that $6 billion saved while $4 billion spent. So a net of $2 billion, is that accurate?
Yeah, I think that's at least the plan. As you know, you never know when they're making the sausage what's really going to come out of it. But I think at the end of the day, the savings are noteworthy. But I think, you know, there's still going to be discussions of like, how are these water providers, how are they going to address this? And what, you know, what are they going to do? And it's going to be a number of factors. They're going to have to invest in things like, you know, digital technologies or just wastewater, water reuse, maybe desalination, brackets desalination in the Central Valley as well.
What other aspects of, I assume all the low hanging fruit for conservation has been, you know, leaky toilet fixtures and leaky, you know, plumbing fixtures in the house have, that's low hanging fruit. So I assume all that stuff's been plumbed as much as it could. Are there other kind of low hanging fruit items you see out there for conservation in California?
Yeah, I think, one is just understanding how much water everybody's using. Let's start with that. But I think the leakage is a good point. I mean, with sort of leakage of the network itself, California actually, according to our data, it does actually pretty well. They're closer to 10% leakage rates, where the U.S. average is about 14 to 15%. So California actually does pretty well. One, newer systems, you know, we're not looking at, you know, Philadelphia, right, where the networks are pretty old. So leakage, water reuse is huge, right? So I think basically taking the water that's going into ocean outfalls, reusing that for other things, whether it be irrigation or even agriculture itself, there are benefits and advantages to do that. I think the other thing that we're going to see, like I mentioned, is digital technologies and understanding flows, where's water going, having a better sort of real-time understanding what's happening within a network just to be more efficient. Lastly, we've talked about this before, and that would be things like desalination. That's still going to, particularly seawater desalination, is a hard sell because of environmental pushback and the cost and the energy impacts.
Yeah. Any thoughts on stormwater harvesting and capture?
Definitely stormwater management is, you know, whether it be types of infrastructure, whether it be road or parks or surface areas, capturing stormwater is always huge. And we just put out a report on stormwater management in the U.S. And I think across the U.S., let alone California, is but I think by 2030, a $54 billion a year market. And that's for commercial real estate, that is for transportation, as well as the cities or utilities themselves. So collectively, those three groups represent a significant amount of spending that's going to happen over the next decade and more.
Do you see this as kind of something that that's going to provide a model for other states or other provinces or countries to use in order to address water scarcity?
I mean, I think one thing that's different about this is it's less reactive to sort of an acute situation like an immediate drought. So what we're going to see is this a harbinger of greater long-term planning with conservation targets that are implemented across multiple systems. So, you know, another example would be a place like Australia after the millennium drought. We see in Southern Europe, we're seeing measures being taken. But the nice thing about this is, and I think you could appreciate this, is thinking out to 2050 as opposed to saying within one political cycle of 4 or 5 years, because if you do it within 4 or 5 years, then it becomes a political issue. When it goes out to 2050, then it impacts, no one feels that they're truly impacted. So I think it's in many respects easier to get things like this done over the long term as opposed to immediately.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I think the proactive nature of it is a positive for folks living in California, because it's thought out more than a knee-jerk, as you say, political cycle reaction.
That's the reality of municipal water, unfortunately, is it is very political, whereas it shouldn't be, but it is. And so I had a conversation with someone from Milwaukee last week, actually at the NACWA conference, and they were talking about implementing measures such as this, whether it be efficiencies, but thinking out with a vision statement out to 2035, where everybody seems to think, oh, it's okay, it doesn't impact me, but yet they get to implement all these different measures. And I think it's really great. So this cool. is what needs to be done.
All right, Reese, we'll have a great conclusion to your unofficial summer here, as school will start ramping up here in August for most folks. And so thanks for all the knowledge you dropped, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right, good to talk to you again, and talk to you next month.
All right, we'll see you. Bye.
Cheers.
As always, great information from Bluefield Research and Reese Tisdale. Now it's time for the main event, our interview with Doug Hattler. So let's get that water flowing. Well, Doug, welcome to the Water Values Podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, David. It's great to see you. I love your podcast, love talking with you, and I appreciate the opportunity to come on and quote-unquote rant and rave about how we're managing people.
Well, I should have said welcome back to the Water Values Podcast. You've obviously been a guest before. A little different setting, though, for your employment. So can you kind of tell us where your journey in water is taking you here recently?
Yeah, the first time we met, I was doing artificial intelligence with a company called Fracta. And what I found, I recently just went to ACE 24 in Anaheim, and I found out that we're credited with being one of the main influences of bringing AI into the water industry. So that's good. But I started in remediation, and then I got into the digital technology and then into the water industry with digital technology. But I seem to have come back to the beginning of my career, where through the work I did with 374 Water, who is developing a supercritical water oxidation technology that can destroy PFAS, I find myself back to where I started in looking at remediation of chemicals that we used in society that have gotten into the environment. And, so I'm bringing today sort of a 38-year perspective of, you know, what we haven't learned over the years and what we need to learn as we go into trying to tackle PFAS.
Yeah. And so earlier this year, we had Snehal Desai from Xylem come on and kind of talk about the regulatory framework that the EPA has now announced. And he kind of talked about, you know, essentially how he views compliance with the rule. You're coming from a different lens in terms of just eradicating PFAS.
Yeah, you know, we at 374 Water, we had worked on a framework, you know, as part of being a sustainable company. We're looking at a framework and trying to get a dialogue going on. It's not just about removal of PFAS from groundwater and soil and surface water, and then destruction of the compounds, not putting it in a landfill or something. There's more to it. You know, we have to take into consideration that PFAS are still being manufactured, processed, and used. There's still the fact that we have millions and millions and millions of tons of product from, you know, that are out in people's use that, you know, that can still contaminate the environment. And so it's a bigger picture, and I like to call it PFAS eradication, which is how do we get PFAS out of society, not just out of the environment?
Right. And so when you talk about that goal, how do you, you know, big picture again, how do you propose to achieve it?
Well, you know, when you go to manage, I would have an MBA and you go to management school and you learn frameworks, right? And you work with the big consulting companies, their frameworks. And it's interesting because there's a specialty conference called Battelle Chlorinator that's going on right now. And there's some really, really talented, very knowledgeable people over there that are talking about PFAS. And one of the things they threw out was a framework that was similar to the greenhouse gas framework of scope 1, 2, and 3. And I started thinking about that this morning as I was coming home on the airport. The way I guess I'm looking at it is you've got the manufacturing and use and creation of PFAS. That is a source of material that gets into the environment. Then you have these products that you're creating from it, whether it's Teflon or Gore-Tex or your pizza boxes or stuff, you know, and they come in contact with the environment. So those are two sources. So when you talk about the manufacturing, you've got air emissions, you've got water that may be going out through the waste water. You may have spill residues that are getting out into the soil or the groundwater. So that's what you'd kind of call the scope one or direct contamination. Then you have what I would call sort of that scope two or indirect contamination, which is, you know, I'm washing a Teflon pot in my house and it goes into my septic system. So is the PFAS coming off the pot and going into the septic system and now going into the groundwater? Right. Then you have, you know, that whole deal, you know, you have the firefighting foams and, you know, firefighters wearing Gore-Tex. So all that, I heard an anecdotal, and I don't know if it's true, where they said somebody did a study in Park Slope, Utah, where they're finding PFAS and they think it might've been from the skis. So that is that idea behind this indirect. And then the third one is the actual environmental contamination. The challenge that I think that I see right now, and I think other people do too, Ali Ling over at St. Thomas University and a number of others, we're rushing to a legislation, regulation, and activity to start remediation. But we're going to remediate and we're going to spend millions. I think some of the estimates are like $40 billion over 10 or 20 years. But we're going to rush to clean up the groundwater soil, but we're still putting PFAS in the water and soil. So we're going to spend all this money, but we're never going to be able to stop doing those treatment systems because we still have sources of PFAS. So the concept is we need to look at the overall eradication of removing PFAS from society. Similar, I guess, to the way it happened with DDT, but it's that. So right now we've got a fragmented approach. You've got a lot of different legislation. You've got TSCA in the United States, CERCLA. You've got RCRA. They all do different things, but there's no harmonized, uniform way of looking at all of this. And because of the estimates and because this isn't the only problem we have, you know, when we said we spoke earlier, David, we talked to Fractal. Well, that was dressing the breaking water main pipes. There's estimates that we need to spend $4-5-digit billion on pipes. We've got that. We've got PFAS. We've got the lead service lines. You know, we have to figure out how to be more efficient in these things. So rushing to clean up PFAS before we stop the sources can be counterproductive in terms of capital efficiency and best use of time and resources. There's a long answer, so I'll let you dissect and ask for questions.
Yeah, I was going to say that's an interesting interesting lens to look through the issue at concerning, hey, we're still producing this stuff. And it's getting into the environment. So why are we essentially we're bailing out a ship that's got a hole, and we're bailing not enough, you know, more water's coming in the ship than
you know what, you got it. I'm just trying to think of a good metaphor analogy, and I think that's what it is. You know, you got a hole in the boat, and instead of trying to get the boat to shore and fix the hole, we're bailing. It's not that we're not trying to get the ship to shore to fix it, but we're bailing, but we're sinking, and the more water you take, the slower it is to get to shore. So,
yeah. Well, I always go back to those water-based analogies, Doug.
Yep.
So, I'm sorry, go ahead.
It is the Water Values Podcast.
Amen. Amen. So b- based on your kind of vision that you're laying out here, what do you look at in terms of times and costs to get that achieved?
Well, I think, you know, you hear estimates of, you know, 10 years. So I think this is going to be a generational problem we have to solve. You know, we've acknowledged that there's a problem. The health studies have been done that says, yes, PFAS can be harmful. Industry is, and you're an attorney, David, so you know, industry is being sued. There's a number of settlements with a bunch of companies. I'm not going to bash on the companies by putting their names out. We know who they are, who made these compounds. So, you know, the remnants of acknowledgement and realizing that there's a problem is there. But I think it's going to be a generation. I think it's a 30-year cycle, I think, on some of these big problems. I think we're moving in the right direction. I do think it's going to be longer. I think it's going to be a lot more expensive, and I think it's going to have some impact on the economy. I haven't done any real economic analysis. You know, again, there's that concept of externalities where, you know, this is an externality of practices from the 50s, 60s, and 70s. But, you know, I think we're talking, you know, probably well over, you know, $100, $200 billion over, you know, or more over the course of 20 to 30 years. I mean, it just comes from my experience having been through seeing some of these other cycles. And then, as you said, it's confounded right now, and it's getting set up because we've got, there's lawsuits still going on. There's some people challenging whether EPA has the actual rights, whether they're overarching. You know, if we go back to the Chevron principle, you know, right now, is EPA plugging gaps with some of the decisions they're making? Because Congress wasn't real clear. You know, we saw that with greenhouse gases. We're still seeing that. So I think, you know, if you think of this in terms of, an S curve, you know, I think we're still in the lag phase, and we, you know, moving towards a direction where we're picking up the pace and going. But as you talked about, picking up the pace of what? Eliminating the compounds, picking up the pace of collecting everyone's PFAS products and getting rid of them so they're not out there anymore? Are we doing it to just clean up the soil and the environment? And I think that's what we have to figure out as practitioners, legislators, policymakers, industry leaders.
Let me ask you this, Doug. Is one of the hurdles we're going to have to get over the fact that, you know, a lot of people are looking at, I mean, you mentioned EPA's regulation of PFAS and the challenges to that. I mean, that's just a small subset of the overall chemical family that is commonly referred to as PFAS, right? And so,
yeah, I mean, I go to conferences and I've heard there are 4,000, and I've heard there's 7,000, I've heard there's over 9,000. PFAS is not a singular compound. We talked about DDT and we talked about PCB, DDT, you know, malathion, parathion, MTBE, those were smaller class of compounds. Maybe there is one compound or maybe a half a dozen or a dozen so, and then breakdown products. There are a lot of different variants of PFAS, and the chemistry of the different types of PFAS vary. They talk about short chain. They talk about long chain. Some have bromide. So there's different chemistries. Then what I'm learning, I'm currently, one of my clients right now is Ultrasonexin out of Montreal. They offer a PFAS removal technology that uses foam fractionation. It separates the PFAS from aqueous solutions, but it doesn't destroy it. But, you know, what we're finding is that you go to a landfill in Minnesota, and there could be seven different cells, and in each cell of that landfill, there's different waste types. So the characterization of the PFAS in each one of those cells can be different. So then you put that soup together into a single equalization tank, you have to come up with addressing just that particular range. Now, I'm not going to jump back into remediation. I just want to use it as an example of, you know, you've got all these different compounds. Then you put them into a soup together with each other. And that even confounds and makes it even more difficult to have to deal with all this. Right now, EPA, I think, is regulated. I think I forget how many compounds under the Safe Drinking Water Act that they came out with. Was it three or four compounds? And then we have the UCM, the Unregulated Contaminant Monitoring Round 5 going on now. And I think that's another 20-something compounds. But that's only, you know, a group of what, that's been 35, 40 compounds out of 4,000 or 5,000. One of my former colleagues at 374 Water, Sudhakar Viswanathan, was saying in a chat that we were having this morning, started by Ali Lang from the Battelle conference, was that we need to come up with a method where, like they did with GHG, where you have all these different GHG gases, but you have a measure of a GHG equivalent. I think that was kind of a novel idea, is how do we come up with a PFAS equivalent that represents a bigger class of the compounds?
Yeah, that's a great idea. So,
yeah, and I want to make sure, because, you know, I we're all sharing thoughts right now, and all the thought leaders have positions, and they're all coming together. So where I can, I want to try to make sure I share my colleagues' thoughts, because it's this, it's going to be, I said soup before about PFAS, but I think it's going to be an intellectual soup, as always, the way we solve problems in the U.S. is once we identify it, the best minds come around, and eventually we all come together and form a consensus around solutions. And I think that's what's also starting to happen right now.
Yeah. So what are the challenges to finding those solutions?
Well, I think one is going to be, you know, the U.S. legislative and regulatory frameworks. I think the politics in the U.S., nobody wants to talk about it anymore because it's so fragmented and so nasty, so to speak. But I think, you know, we're going to see that. Talking to people at ACE, you know, there's going to be a ruling on, and maybe you can shed a light on this, but there's going to be a Supreme Court, I think, decision around the Chevron principle, I think it is.
Yeah, Chevron is under attack for sure. And for those who...
Yeah, and if that, then the question is, does that... in fact, I know one company that's actually talking to one of the research companies and asking him, can you do a little analysis for us and tell us that, you know, based on that, if the Chevron ruling is struck down, does anything in the PFAS fall apart? Because there's two implications to that. One is there's the implication of what does that do to strategy and policy? But the other implication is this is an industry that's building up, right? There's a PFAS industry that's being created right now that's forming to solve this problem. But, you know, in the U.S., we solve it through capital markets and businesses and profit and loss. And so people are making bets on technologies and business plans and capital investments. And, you know, the best way to get industry and people to move is through a regulation. I've always joked that environmental work, you know, there's nothing better for the environmental industry than a good regulation or an administrative consent order, right?
Yeah. So what's your perspective, given your 38 years of history in the environmental field? I mean, I think part of the issue with these with chemical contamination is that oftentimes the line between the contamination and the effect are blurred a little bit, and yeah, they're not so free markets don't readily build those in, you know, build the cost of the chemical per se into the effect. And that's where regulation comes in to plug the gap, because
correct. That's the externality in it that they call it in economics, right? And that's the whole
thing,
the environment. So the regulations come in, one, to make sure that industry is working in a manner that is protective of public health and the environment.
So Doug, what do you view as some of the other challenges besides kind of the regulatory framework that's kind of
Yeah, that near and dear to me, you know, at a more tactical level, you know, the control technologies right now, they've identified, and there's a great presentation at ACE, Black and Veatch was presented, a couple other people presented, you know, the best available control technologies that we're using are granular activated carbon, ion exchange resins, high temperature incineration, some advanced oxidation processes, membranes, thermal desorption. So these are typical, let's call them conventional, accepted technologies that are proven. So they're the best available control technology. So a lot of the economic models of things are being based on these. But these particular, except for the thermal desorption or the high temperature insertion, they're only separating PFAS. There's still the whole destruction piece of it. So I think one of the challenges is, and I'll say for granular activated carbon and ion exchange resins, there are methods for reactivation or regeneration. where, for instance, in activated carbon, there's reactivation where at very, very high temperatures, close to incineration temperatures, you know, you can break down the PFAS and then the carbon can then be reused. But in these other cases, in the membranes and the RO or reverse osmosis, you're creating a slipstream or a side stream or a reject where you still have the PFAS, but it's highly concentrated now. And the emerging destruction technologies besides, let me take a step back and say EPA just updated its guidance on disposal and destruction. And they've identified that right now, landfilling, deep well injection, and you know, high temperature incineration and technologies like that are the three that we have right now. And they endorse those as the way to go. So we're still saying it's okay to put it in a landfill. It's still okay to put it in a deep injection well. And it's still okay to put it in an incinerator. But we have a number of emerging technologies that look very, very promising. I mentioned earlier with 374 water, supercritical water oxidation. So there's 374 water, General Atomics, and Revive Environmental, which is using the Battelle annihilator. So we've got supercritical water, but no one has deployed a major scale system where EPA will say endorse it. They're encouraging people to go ahead and do pilots and use it and share the data. You've got electrochemical oxidation, a company like Aclarity, and I think it's E2 Metrics. You've got, and then you've got some other, I think, plasma technologies and so forth. Those technologies are ones, there's another one by Aquaga called HALT, hydrothermal alkaline treatment. Those technologies have a promise for being able to be deployed on site. So now you can use a technology like, you can take the carbon or the others, or you can use what we call foam fractionation in some cases, where we can separate and concentrate the PFAS on site. And then we can put one of these on-site destruction units after it so that we don't have to take the concentrated PFAS and cart it off to a landfill or an incinerator, you know, 500 or 1,000 miles away. You know, you're not going to get an incinerated permitted, a landfill permitted, or a deep well injection new one permitted easily, you know, to cover regional remediation sites. So if we can move these control technologies, these emerging technologies along, we can put solutions on site that can actually collect, separate, destroy, you know, and because there's other elements that go into it too, as you're sending trucks off, you know, you've got transportation risk, and now you're putting more GHG and you're using more fossil fuel, putting more GHGs in the air, taking these things far away. So that's one of the other challenges, is the accelerating the provenness, quote unquote, and getting adoption of these emerging technologies. There's good investment flowing into them. The DOD, you know, is accelerating this through the work that they're doing under their mandates to clean up their bases. There are some responsible companies out there that are moving ahead, even though the regulatory environment is still kind of gray and murky. So I think those folks that are putting some money out into trying to get these systems scaled up into pilot and even into a maybe not a full-scale deployment, but what would be a full commercialized deployment, I think those are really, really, really good. Now, again, I'm going to go back to the framework that was kind of developing out of some folks talking out of Battelle and that I jumped into, was that's dealing with your scope three, right? That's dealing with, that remediation, the stuff that's already in the environment.
Yeah.
We still have to deal with, you know, and I know there's through TSCA and through regulation of new chemicals, they're trying to figure out how to replace PFAS and all that. That's a challenge. You know, there's a whole industry around you based on using these compounds. We still need to figure that out. And then what do we do with the billion, probably millions and billions of tons of consumer goods that are still out in circulation that have PFAS in them that might still be contributing to as a source? Those I don't have an answer for, and I'm not as close to those. All I'm saying is, and that was when I opened up and said I'm going to rant and rave, I think there needs to be a lot more time spent talking about those two. And then there's another one that's near and dear to my heart, because when I worked at 374 Water, 374 Water is super critical water. Technology was based on being able to take biosolids. There are PFAS in biosolids. PFAS in biosolids, you take the biosolids, you turn them into a fertilizer, you put them on a farm field. We see in Maine, I think we've seen in New Mexico, they have documentation of the PFAS going, you know, through the food cycle and turning out in the dairy cows. So we have this idea of, you know, we spent 30 to 40 years creating an industry around using biosolids for fertilizer. Now we're finding that they have PFAS, but there's also other emerging contaminants. There's pharmaceutical compounds and all that. How do we do that? Because there, I know in my state of South Carolina, we're investing a lot of money in some additional, you know, composting and reuse of those. What do you do with those investments now if you find that those materials have PFAS in them, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So if I could just summarize to make sure I've got you.
This. So, please go ahead.
So the challenges you see, Doug, are regulatory framework, ubiquitous nature. It's everywhere and there's a lot of it. And the market is currently supplying just a limited number of substitutes of that can take the place of PFAS compounds. And then destruction and remediation technologies are still, they're still in their infancy.
Let's call them toddlers.
Okay. They're still toddlers. Well,
we have the conventionals that are, you know, senior adults, the incineration, the depot, but the other ones, yeah, they're moving from infancy to toddlers. But we're moving so fast, I think, to getting into remediation that we may be moving past what we can currently do. And we're going to run into, you know, so that adds to creating, you know, do we have enough? There's going to be more demand than supply for offsite disposal and destruction, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Another economic issue.
So as we're talking about the continuum, and I initially said infancy, and you kind of corrected me and said, no, we're in the toddler stage. Where are we kind of globally on the whole PFAS journey? Where do you see us falling on that spectrum?
Australia has been moving pretty aggressively. But I'll have to admit, it's a little gap in my knowledge. I've been very focused in the U.S. I've been focused in Australia because that's where I've been conducting business. I do think there's probably some activity going on, or at least some view going on in the European Union. But I don't know if it's as drastic and immediate as what we're doing here. So I guess I have to throw out and be big about it and say I'm not quite sure. Globally. But it's interesting when you say globally, there's a word that's out there. If you remember, you know, we have the right, the community, the EPCRA, the right to know regulations, right? And then we had REACH that was put out and all the different hazardous substance labeling standards that were different by country. You know, when you ask me that question, it brings up the word that gets thrown out is harmonization. How do we harmonize these three scopes? But not only that, but harmonize it so if this is a global problem, we can create harmonized global templates that will work across. Because as we know from the greenhouse gas and climate change, and we know from other things that it's one continuous earth and system, right?
Absolutely, yeah. So Doug, you've provided a great broad overview. I've really appreciated the conversation. You've brought up some new concepts. You've kind of really, in my view, really kickstarted the conversation around, you know, PFAS eradication, and kind of different lenses to look through that in. So what's your leave behind message? What do you want the listener to take with them?
I think we have to continue developing and moving through the way U.S. approaches problems, which is we have existing legislation, the fastest, particularly in a deadlocked Congress like we have now. We have to use the legislation we have to create the tools that will force the majority. If you think of it as you're going to have some early adopter and visionary companies that are going to do it because it's the right thing to do, and then you'll have some organizations out there that will do it once they see they do it, and then you'll have the mass market and the laggards. I think that using the existing legislative and regulatory frameworks is important to start moving things through. So those who are sitting and waiting for a regulatory driver to move will start moving. But I think from where we are as a country in the U.S. and where we are our debt levels, The fact that we have Russian warships in Cuba, we're watching two wars in Ukraine. The economic priorities of the United States, we're going to be extremely challenged. So we really, what I challenge us all is we have to think about the most efficient ways to deal with this. And I don't want to get in, and I don't want to leave behind saying we have to look at the cost benefit analysis. I think we have to look at what's the best way to look at this for society. And we need to look at it holistically. We can't just look at it the way we may have done in the past with things, which is fragmented. We need to look at it and start thinking of a harmonized approach to this. You know, again, as you brought up, and I'll take it back to, we can't just keep bailing water out of a sinking ship. We've got to get the ship to land, fix it, get the water out, and then get back to the business of economic development in the country, taking care of our citizens and making sure everyone has a clean, healthy opportunity for, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Great. Well, Doug, well said. I really appreciate the time you've spent with us today. Thank you so much. For those who want to find out more about you and your work, where can they go to get that information?
So my email is dhatler@envbizvin.com. And you can email me there. I do have a website that's same thing, envbizvin.com. And you can drop me a line through that. And I'm a very prolific LinkedIn user. The easiest way to probably reach me is through LinkedIn.
Awesome. Well, Doug, thanks again. Great speaking with you, and look forward to seeing you around the block.
Thank you, David. I appreciate the opportunity. I realize this may not have been the most coherent and baked this talk, but I think it's important that we have this debate. And I think, you know, one last thing to say is, and I think after seeing some of the discussion coming out of the Battelle chlorinated, perhaps we may be moving down the road of coming up with a framework like we're doing with the GHG frameworks that can be adopted globally to come up with a strategy for eradication of PFAS from society.
Awesome. Well, again,
cheers,
Doug.
David.
Yep. Thanks so much. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
An absolute great interview by Doug. Always enjoy catching up with him and hearing his insights on environmental issues. Keep up the good fight, Doug. You're doing great. Would love to know what you thought about the interview. Please check out the show notes page for information and links on this episode. Just Google the Water Values Podcast. Click the first link that comes up. That's our home on the web. As you know, Bluefield Research and the Water Values Podcast, the Water Values LLC, are not affiliates. We just have a joint marketing arrangement. And as part of that, the Blue Water Values Podcast gets a home on Bluefield Research's website. You can also email me at david.mcgimsey@dentons.com, and you can sign up for the newsletter at that landing page as well. Thank you again for tuning in, and I hope you make it a great day. Plus, I want to give a huge thank you to our sponsors. Again, sponsors of the Water Values Podcast include 120 Water, Advanced Drainage Systems, 1898 & Co., Woodard & Curran, Intera, Xylem, the American Water Works Association, and Black & Veatch. And this show would not be possible without those great companies and industry leaders. And thank you again for listening and for subscribing to the Water Values Podcast. Your support is truly appreciated. Well, in closing, please remember to keep the core message of the Water Values Podcast in mind as you go about your daily business. Water is our most valuable resource, so please join me by going out into the world and acting like it.
Listening to the Water Values Podcast. Thank you for spending some of your day with my dad and me.
Well, thank you for tuning in to the disclaimer. I'm a lawyer licensed in Indiana and Colorado, and nothing in this podcast should be taken as providing legal advice or as establishing an attorney-client relationship with you or with anyone else. Additionally, nothing in this podcast should be considered a solicitation for professional employment. I'm just a lawyer that finds water issues interesting and that believes greater public education is needed about water issues. And that includes enhancing my own education about water issues because no one knows everything about water.